So what we're going to do now is move from physics to biology with Elizabeth Sartoris, who will be known to many of you. Elizabeth, I think, is one of the foremost biologists arguing for a living universe, when most of the microbiologists, at any rate, are arguing for a dead mechanical universe. And I think she will show how this is actually a contradiction in terms how we really need a new view of biology, incorporating life and consciousness. And a dead biology is actually a contradiction in terms, and yet that seems to be what we've got. So Elizabeth's talk this morning, and she's flown in not quite as far as Dennis, but from Mallorca, and has to go a little bit early this afternoon for another event that she's hosting tomorrow morning, where she's got Satish Kumar and other people walking 5 kilometres in support of local farmers in Mallorca. And she's going to talk about consciousness as primary or emergent in theories of evolution, implications for science and the human future. Elizabeth.
Good morning, everybody. We're off to a roaring start already. And if I may speak to the observation question before I start, it seems to me that Dennis showed us definitions of Brahman that included witness as one of the descriptions of Brahman. So if cosmic consciousness itself is witness to its own thought, then your question is answered, and so is yours, I think. One possible way of looking at it. If we believe in the primacy of consciousness, we're making this all up as we go anyway. So all we've got is stories, and there are many stories, and each story is a reality to its storyteller. So my son would say, "Don't pull the rug out from under me that way," implying I need my Cartesian coordinates if this universe is going to make sense. And then I respond, "Look at the hummingbird. Doesn't know a thing about Cartesian coordinates. In fact, scientists say can't fly." I'm a biologist. Nature seems to work quite well, quite amazingly so. Would that we people can come to function as well as nature does. Again, before I really get going, I want to thank Dennis, because it was a great setup for me for you to deal with in detail with what axioms are and how they function, how they underlie endeavors such as Euclidean geometry and Newtonian physics and so forth. I've long been interested in languages, human languages, including our artificially constructed languages of math and logic, which we found out in the last century were the same kind of constructed languages. Now, these constructed languages are very neat and clean. They were invented not to change over time unless you fiddled with the axioms. And of course, people have fiddled with Euclidean axioms, and a number of branches of new mathematics arose from doing so. As long as you want to do Euclidean geometry, you can't change the axioms, but you can do geometries with slightly different set of axioms, and whole new kinds of math come up. So these artificial languages are subsets of natural language, living languages that you learn at your mother's knee. And you cannot, in other words, you can teach algebra in Chinese or English, in any language, but you cannot teach Chinese in algebra. It's a subset, you see, it's embedded within. And these nice, neat, constructed languages are very good for doing nice, neat things like Euclidean geometry and mechanics. But they don't work so well for science as a whole, because science has to do some describing in natural language in order to get on with it. So these you might call fundamental assumptions rather than formal axioms. And there are, of course, fundamental assumptions underlying science, such as the number one, this is a non-living universe. Western science is founded, among other fundamental assumptions, on the assumption that this is a non-living universe. Now, that's a very interesting assumption, because most human cultures saw all nature as alive. And the concept of non-life itself was a human invention that arose along with mechanics, I believe. And I think it's fair, in a sense, to distinguish between mechanics as non-life and the rest of the world as living. So one could just as easily take the fundamental assumption that this is a living universe. But science didn't, Western science didn't, because it came out of mechanical models. Its founders were obsessed with robots on clock towers and the ancient Greek idea of spheres within spheres and tracking the movements of the planets. I don't know why this is going down so fast if I don't move it. And so we got this very mechanistic idea of the universe with metaphors that all came from machinery for a very long time. And that has been changing for some time now, but it's so deeply embedded, especially in biology, that it's very hard to get away from. Now, physics was considered the leading science, the fundamental science that would explain how this non-living universe worked. And then biology had to kind of fit itself into physics. And in fact, in physics language, life is called negentropy, right? Entropy is the dissolution of the physical world, which apparently started with a kind of battery Big Bang and has been running down ever since. And then when biologists came along and said, yes, but life builds up its patterns, its formation, its energy. And so they decided to call it negentropy because it was going against the tide of entropy. But physicists insisted life will lose in the end and the negentropy will fail. And of course, Darwinian biology is about how life is an endless struggle in scarcity. Of course, he admittedly got his theory from Malthus when he says, Darwin says in The Origin of Species, this is the doctrine of Malthus applied to every aspect of nature. How many of you knew that? Some of you did, okay. Most people don't. Doesn't seem to get into the education system very clearly. But it was a bit unfair because Malthus was referring to human-created food supplies and reproduction. And if nature was to be completely impersonal and unintelligent and proceeding by accident and all that, then was it fair? Was it fair of Darwin to take the concept of breeding animals, which required intelligent selection, and apply it to nature where scientists don't see any intelligence? So the metaphors get very mixed up in science, and it often confuses the issue so that it's very difficult to get clean pictures of what's going on. In any case, I also want to say that stunning as it has been, quantum theory may yet be replaced. I won't say any more on that now or I'll get away from biology. But it's a little bit difficult to talk about consciousness in the scientific and medical network since there are so many experts on the subject in this organization and people like David Lorimer and Rupert Sheldrake and Pete Russell and all these wonderful people trained in Western science have many of them, including myself, done what I call the 180-degree turn. When basically you shift from the concept of consciousness as a late emergent product of material evolution to the concept, the Advaita Vedanta concept of consciousness as primary. And so you showed us these two extremes, in a sense, of how you do axioms in Western science and how you can be just as rigorous about your axioms in Vedantic science. And what happens when Western scientists with PhDs decide that something's wrong with the fundamental assumptions and move to the Vedantic assumptions, what are you then? Are you still a Western scientist? Have you become a Vedantist? it's strange because you see you're the same person and you're still interested in doing experiments and being a good scientist, but you've discovered that science rests on cultural beliefs, non-provable concepts of what kind of universe you live in. And you must choose those. There is no way to develop a science without them. However, most scientists believe they're dealing in facts. They've forgotten that you can't prove theories. And they forget that they have these assumptions. So when I give a lecture on the living universe, quite often a scientist will come up to me afterwards and say, I loved your poetic metaphors, but of course this isn't really science, is it? Wink, wink. And then I'd say, why do you say that? And they say, well, because you can't prove it. I say, prove what? And they say, prove this is a living universe. You can't, can you? And I say, very interesting. Maybe you could help me by explaining to me how you proved that this was a non-living universe. Well, they look at you funny for a moment and then say, you don't have to. I say, why is that? And they say, because it's obvious. I say, well, it's not been obvious to other cultures in the world and still isn't to many. And they say, well, that's because they're pre-scientific. That's the end of the argument, right? So I've been dealing with this matter for some time now, and as a result of it, I organized a symposium of scientists and philosophers who had made the 180-degree turn from consciousness last to consciousness first in Hokkaido last year, and we talked about these fundamental assumptions of science. And we spent quite a lot of time listing all the fundamental assumptions we had been taught in graduate school about our universe, and then went through the same exercise for what were the fundamental assumptions that we believed now and how did they differ. And the long-range plan, if I ever raise the requisite 75,000 euros for GlobeScan to do this study, is to develop an instrument on which scientists who were trained in Western science, because it is as yet the only acknowledged science in the world today, the official science of the world is Western science. And this is a problem because many cultures have trouble with these fundamental assumptions. And so the long-range plan is, could we get a consortium of sciences in the world in which each science would publicly state its fundamental assumptions, the closest thing to axioms that we get in founding sciences, and then build their theories and talk about their methodology, be transparent about it all. And then we could have a science built on the living universe concept. Or Islamic science could reconstitute itself and claim its right to exist as a science, and its fundamental assumptions would include the creation by Allah of the living universe, and then they would study the living universe. And as I say to them, you're not going to get your credentials from Western science. You're going to have to stand up and insist on your right to have this science by doing something Western science can't do. Now, for a long time, many of us in this network and like-minded scientists have assumed that what's happening here is an evolution in the sense of Thomas Kuhn, where new paradigms replace old paradigms. Now, in my theory of evolution, which is really just an amalgam of Darwinian evolution and, let's say, Kropotkin's theory of evolution, which was taught in the Soviet Union and is about cooperation in nature. And in Darwinian, it's about competition in nature. If you put those two together and look back at the linear material history of this planet, and humans, of course, although we have no experience outside of now, and the deepest reality of the universe is an eternal now, humans cannot function in a physical world without inventing linear time to make sense of our experience in the physical world. And the physical world, as Dennis said, if you're invested in it, it's very real. If you, you know, it's very real to us, right? And we need clocks or we wouldn't all be here at the right hour to listen to each other and stuff like that. So it's very, very useful. It works. And in the universe, I think the things that work well are the things that tend to persist. Those that don't work well, those that don't work out harmony with other things, tend not to persist for too long. The human experiment results aren't in yet, and we are being kind of seriously tested at present. let me go on to... In the mid-90s, I wrote a book with Willis Harmon. Some of you probably know his work on global mind shifting, and he was the founder of the World Business Academy for Progressive Businesses, and a wonderful futurist, a Renaissance thinker. When I knew him, he was president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which some of you know about, I'm sure, which was founded by Ed Mitchell, the moonwalking astronaut after his epiphany on the moon. And in the introduction to that book, which I wrote with Willis, and by the way, the question that Willis had posed to me was, what if we assume consciousness as primary? How would it change biology, and how would it change society as a whole? And that book was published in the 90s. And in the introduction to it, I wrote, recently I ran into a note I had scribbled some years after finishing graduate school. And my note to myself said, I sometimes think I was awarded a PhD for successfully denying my humanity, behaving mechanically, dissecting nature without feeling or emotion. And of course, at the time I was trained in the 50s, it was a sin as a scientist to do anything called anthropomorphism, projecting human qualities onto the rest of nature. And I said, yeah, but you're trying to make me do mechanomorphism, and mechanomorphism is a derivative of anthropomorphism because man invented machinery. And they'd say, what's your agenda, commie? Why don't you go back to Russia? I mean, they just couldn't figure out. You know, McCarthyism and all that. They couldn't figure out what I was talking about. And I have spent many years talking myself blue in the face about the importance of metaphor. And it wasn't until the book Complexity came out when Brian Arthur, one of the physicists at the Santa Fe Institute, which that book was about, wrote, the task of science is choosing the appropriate metaphors. And if we want to talk about a living universe, you can't keep doing it in machine terms. Because machines and living systems, mechanisms and organisms, run on very different principles. A mechanism, for example, requires an outside inventor, somebody to think it up, make the pieces, put them together for some purpose that that inventor has. That inventor, in fact, is exactly like Descartes' God. Descartes' God was the grand engineer inventing the machinery of nature and putting a piece of God mind in his favorite robot, which was man, so that he too could invent machinery. Now, we may think that story a little silly nowadays, but it was logically complete. It accounted for the intelligence both at the universal level and the human level. So it's closer to Advaita Vedanta, isn't it, in some ways? And maybe when Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, was getting close. He probably should have said, I am, therefore I think. I don't know. But anyway, it's a chicken-egg question, isn't it? So then I wanted to tell you also something that Brian Goodwin, who's also someone who was all much of his life associated with this group, from an interview he did with John Brockman, he said, that's why people are now, I feel, very suspicious of science, because it is fundamentally wounding, splitting scientists in two, and alienating people from nature by turning it into an object. people have an instinct to heal this separation. They want to add holistic medicine to the analytical tradition. They want holistic styles of living. And this is what drove this whole move toward this different paradigm, this different set of fundamental assumptions, I believe. So is it, however, a paradigm shift in the Kuhnian sense, where the new assumptions, which are actually old Vedantic assumptions, will replace those that Western science has been operating on since Galileo and Newton and people like that? Or should we have these two sciences operating in parallel? And I think that the latter now is more important to me because, as I said, my evolution biology talks about competition and cooperation in the sense of a maturation cycle where from the ancient bacteria on, natural species have been going through feisty, competitive, adolescent, creative phases into the discovery, basically, that feeding your enemy is cheaper than killing them. It is more energy efficient to build cooperative alliances, thereby having no more energy, any enemies that you have to waste energy fighting, and being in a mature cooperative system. Now, we know this from human experience. We expect feisty adolescents, you know, to know it all and be competitive and combative and all that, and we expect them to mature into cooperative citizens at some point in their midlives, at least. And so it's quite anthropomorphic, of course, to project this onto nature, but once you see it, you can't unsee it again. Even biologists talk about type 1 ecosystems and type 3 ecosystems, and one is called pioneer and three is called climax, implying a progression. But if you ask what is the progression, they'll say different kind of species move in. Well, to me, this is like if aliens come down to the planet and see babies crawling on all fours, and then children running and playing, and old people standing upright doing things, and then older people with white hair bent over. It's like four species, right? Because they don't stay around long enough to see the connection, that they're maturing in through these various phases. So if you see that the ancient bacteria resolved into the cooperative phase by building the first, the only other kind of cell besides bacteria on the planet, which is the nucleated cell, as cooperative communities with divisions of labor, and everybody gives some of their DNA to the central DNA library called a nucleus, and wow, you have a whole huge leap in evolution. That took 2 billion years to get to that stage. For another billion years, those big cells are in the feisty competitive juvenile phase until they build multi-celled creatures as their cooperatives, like us. Okay? So what's happening now? Globalization is a process in which we're moving into the last stages of hostile competition, knowing that we need to cooperate. Now, as you said, your last conference was Crisis as Opportunity. The big leaps in evolution have always come through crises. Every time there's an extinction wiping up to 95% of species out, you get a flowering of new species all over the planet. Why? What if you assume that consciousness is primary? Then you see immediately what's happening. The Earth is functioning as a whole. And even biologists who don't believe in consciousness as primary should see it because it's one common DNA pool. The first World Wide Web was invented by bacteria billions of years ago. Any bacterium to this day can trade DNA information with any other. And you are constantly breathing in bits of DNA and prions and freons and all kinds of things like that that are circulating in your body and can be picked up by your genome. And we've known since Barbara McClintock that genomes change themselves intelligently in response to stress. And Eshel Ben-Yaakov in Tel Aviv has found group mind in bacteria. And he used to be in a listserv with me about 15 years ago when I was trying to tell people the difference between mechanical and organic metaphors. and saying, how come biologists who are mechanists, microbiologists who are mechanists, can talk about editor genes and then say there's no intelligence there? You know, editor, it means an intelligent choice. Yeah, I think the genome knows what it's doing because I have a fundamental assumption that consciousness is primary. So all nature is intelligent. Brahman is fine with me, and witness to all. And I think about, what is a human mind? You know, William James said, consciousness is a perch and a flight. And when I do color slides, I have an eagle slide for this one. The perch is that every person, every cell, every molecule, every subatomic particle is a point of witness in the universe. It has a different point of view in the universe, and each is coextensive with the entire universe. How many of you have ever read the Seth books of Jane Roberts? Hands up a little higher. Yeah, some of you are familiar. Seth had exactly this kind of a view of things. He called them CUs, consciousness units. And as soon as he said, of course, there are no such things as units at this level because it's non-dual. But it's a different perspective. And each one is coextensive with the universe. And as Seth said, it is absolutely essential in creating a physical world for every consciousness unit involved, and there can be millions of them within one subatomic particle, to have complete freedom to associate with whatever other consciousness units it wants to, and they build worlds. You know, they build worlds, and then they can build other worlds. And our consciousnesses are a consciousness unit at our size level, as I say, in each of our cells. We have up to 100 trillion cells, all knowing what they're doing. In biology, we humans gave up knowing how to conduct ourselves for free choice. We gave up communion for communication. Our cells know what they're doing. And every cell in your body, up to 100 trillion of them, has about 1,000 banks giving out free money all day long. Never have to pay it back. It's like a stored value credit card. You spend it into the economy to make things happen. All chemical reactions require this one kind of currency called ATP, adenosine triphosphate, to function. And when the credit limit has been spent, goes back to the banks. The bankers are called mitochondria, and they're descendants of ancient free-living bacteria. They put a new credit level on it and give it back to you. Now, there's absolutely no reason why humans at our level can't invent the same kind of a money system to make an economy work for everybody. No reason why we can't. But we sit around saying, well, money is money, and what can you do? And, you know, geez, we don't have enough. And maybe the ATM machines won't work next month. Or one day we'll wake up and they won't work because the economy has collapsed. And the same number of people will be here in the world, the same amount of farmland, the same factories, machinery, all that. But human consciousness will say, oh, end of the world. And some people will jump out of windows over the changed blips on screens, which are patterns of ownership and stuff like that. And, you know, what will happen? What are we going to do, people? This can very well happen. And our sea levels are probably rising, and we're helping to co-create this by being terrified of it. Adds a lot of energy to this process. You see, once you shift into believing consciousness as primary, you really have to watch what you think about, how you relate to other people, what you talk about, what we're co-creating as a world culture, as a community, and to respect that no two realities are identical, that we have to get along with each other in this world, regardless of which stories we tell, which fundamental assumptions we make about the universe, and so on. So it's a very interesting time we live in. We're creating our own crisis. And we do it both through thought and through actions. I used to sit around with Jim Lovelock in the 80s, and he would say to me, Elizabeth, pray for an ice age, because I think humans are going to tip this into a hot age. And I don't know why nobody's calling it a hot age, because at this point, the new predictions of 6.3 degrees hotter by the end of century, and I wager to say that could happen quicker, because an exponential curve, you know, goes very suddenly very steep. What are we doing here? You know, we tilted the balance in that way through physical actions, overloading the atmosphere with pollutants, et cetera, and we're also doing it mentally. We're going along with the program. If you believe the Seth worldview, you can still shift out of this reality and go into one where it doesn't happen. It's a matter of training your mind to do it. If now, even physicists are now writing papers on this idea of probable selves in alternate realities and stuff. It's become a fascinating world. The Cartesian coordinates, that solid framework, that old family house, that taking on your father's job, that being the mother who raises the children sort of solid world has evaporated on us. And it's very helpful, in my view, to adopt the consciousness primary hypothesis or fundamental assumption, because then you build yourself a new way of making friends, of sharing stories, of respecting each other's rights to our worldviews. I have an informally adopted son in the Peruvian Andes, and in his culture, which they call Runakuna, and the language Runasimi, we call it Quechua. Was a misunderstanding on the part of conquistadors that got it that name. It actually means valley in their language. But in his culture, reality is defined as everyone's experience. Everyone's experience. And the rules of the culture, number one rule of the culture is integrity. Tell me your experience with integrity. Don't manipulate me by distorting your experience. Tell it true, the way it is for you. Then I will accept it as your experience, and I can have mine, and it doesn't have to be the same. If you were out driving with your spouse last night, and at breakfast you say, "Why did you tell me to turn right last night and got us lost?" at that point. And the other one says, "I didn't, I told you to turn left." If you didn't have a tape recorder on in the car, what happens here? Two people have two realities, and the only way to resolve them into one reality is through a bullying match. Right? The stronger one bullies the other one into accepting their version of the reality. Now, Western science has been engaged in a huge bullying match. It has told the world there is one reality, and we have it. Right? And they don't look at their fundamental assumptions, and they say, this is how the world is. The other assumptions are, you can study it objectively without interfering in it. You can distance yourself from it. It's not participatory. And, you know, a bunch of other things that go along with that. It's a non-living universe. It can be studied objectively. Consciousness is a late emergent product of it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a whole cultural story. But it has been told to the world as the only story there is outside of religion. And how are we doing on time?
Just under 10 minutes.
Got 10 minutes, good. Just under 10 minutes. So my view of it is we need a consortium of sciences so that when Western science, which is brilliant at making moon rockets and space travel and computers and wonderful communication technologies, it just has to learn that the applications must be recyclable and not have toxins in them if we want a good life. Then I say, let it live. Let it live as a science. Let's not do the conquest model where we replace that paradigm, but get them to open up about their assumptions and say alternative assumptions are possible. And if we could do this global study, where scientists who have PhDs in Western science could answer what their fundamental assumptions are, you would find, you know, different peaks. You'd find different sets of assumptions had actually been adopted by them, depending on whether their in an Islamic culture or in a Vedic culture or in a biological field or whatever, and say, let them live the way the religions do. Religions are meeting more and more often in friendly ways, world parliaments of religion, and many other interfaith dialogues going on in the world in mutually respectful ways. If we could do that with science, then when Western science oversteps its bounds and starts messing in the genome with genetic engineering or developing high-tech agriculture that produces deserts in the name of making gardens, then the science with the living universe assumption can say, try to see it from our perspective and why you're so good at machinery that you fail to understand life. So let's talk about that and see where technology is appropriate in another world, in the world that's coming. So that's my view, and then leave it open to young people who may be having wonderful time with alien cultures who see the universe quite differently, and let them then state their assumptions as they get more information from intergalactic cultures or whatever, and let them have a science based on those assumptions. So that's my proposal for what we should do, and I haven't looked very much at my notes. I've had lots of them, and it doesn't matter, because what I'd really like to do is take a few questions myself also, as Dennis did, and see what did I leave out? Did I answer to the question of biology and what a conscious universe means to a biologist, if not asked me?
Great. Thank you very much, Elizabeth. So we'll take a question in the third and fourth row. There's two in fact.
Yes, I can see how, going back to what you said earlier about cooperation, I can see how multicellular organisms came about by single cells learning to cooperate. But humans aren't made by 50 trillion cells coming together to cooperate. They actually start out from one cell, which reproduces. So that's rather a big step evolutionary-wise, isn't it? Are there any ideas in that?
About reproduction?
You've got two different systems, haven't you? You don't have 50 trillion cells coming together to cooperate to form a human.
Yes, exactly.
So how
right.
could you get from one state to the other?
Yes, you have both divergence and convergence. You have both divergence and convergence in nature, so that, for instance, the early Earth's crust was a homogeneous mass of minerals, and then it packaged itself into individual bacteria. So there was a unity that split up into individuality. Then those individuals came together to build the nucleated cell, right? Then that cell reproduced, and lots of individuals came out of the new model. And for another billion years, they go through the creative, feisty mode of developing different lifestyles, and then they converge again. So you have this... You know, everything in the universe, I find, has, in the physical world, has duality, right? Non-duality belongs to Brahman, to source. But within that source, it's impossible to create worlds without dualities. And I love one of the Hindu creation stories is about the world starting as a smooth sea of milk, endless, unruffled Brahman. In this case, a big mama image. And then a little wavelet forms. And forever after, the little wavelet is torn between loving its unique identity and wanting to merge back into the big mama. Get scared, right? I think that tension between the individual and the whole drives all of evolution. It's a duality. It's something distinct from, right? So I don't know if that answers your question, but you get it both ways. And now in our world, here we are, our brains developed from a single neuron over evolution. They were not, as Pete Russell had it at one point, an assembly of 10 billion neurons, right? And nor will we form a global brain when there are 10 billion people. Hopefully we won't get to that number at all. It'll be a mess, not a global brain, if we do. So you have to see these dualities coming from both sides. And the global family we're building now is a new unity at a higher level again. Every time you go through this maturation circle, you've started with some unity, like that early earth crust. It diversifies into individuals. They get feisty and competitive. Then they learn the advantage of cooperation and build another unity at a larger size level in the physical world. So we went from the bacterial cell to the nucleated cell, which is thousands of times bigger than a bacterium. And now one more aspect, version of this maturation is globalization, where humans are moving out of the hostile competition. More than a million NGOs building a better world at grassroots level. An internet in which young people are cooperating and giving to each other. There, I can give you tons of examples of the cooperation building in our world. Does that help?
You were more expansive than I thought I was expecting, but okay, thank you.
Yes. We've got time for one more question, which I think may be your next door neighbour.
You spoke about consciousness as primal, and it's in your title, you say consciousness or consciousness as an emergent property, presumably you're saying it's not emergent, it's not a result of increasing complexity. Is that right?
Yes. However, a consciousness does evolve in different ways depending on how it plays out within individuals, species, and people, and all that.
Did you say consciousness does evolve?
I believe it evolves. Some of the people I know who tune into the Earth see the Earth, the consciousness of that living planet being evolving, changing. Our consciousness evolves through our lifetime, and I assume that the experience even of Brahman is evolutionary, in a sense.
Because what I was wondering is it possible, this whole question of what was there at the beginning, that all knowledge for the natural world that we now have was there at the beginning?
Linear time, remember, is an invention of human beings. The deep reality of the universe is an eternal now. So, yeah, it's all there at once.
Yes.
And so it's hard for us to grok that.
Exactly.
So I'm saying the Western science idea that consciousness came out of non-consciousness, that intelligence comes out of non-intelligence, this does not make sense to me any longer. And if you take the Advaita Vedanta assumptions, it just doesn't make sense. And yet science spends a huge amount of effort and time, big conferences on consciousness being squeezed out of neurons and exactly how that can work and stuff. And they make stories convincing to each other because they share the fundamental assumptions. You see, you can always build a culture on the things you do agree on without having to have identical realities. But the more you share fundamental assumptions, the more likely you are to agree that your stories make sense. Right?
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. I think we'll leave it there.
Okay.
I mean, there's an old joke about people arguing from different premises where the premises mean different buildings. And it was almost as if, you know, we are in these different buildings. And we're in a new building this morning, which has been helped to be constructed, or the forms are being constructed by Dennis and by Elizabeth. And I think what's so helpful about getting back to the assumptions is that it makes one aware of where one's coming from oneself, because obviously we all have a starting point, we all have a viewpoint. And to make that explicit rather than it remaining implicit is a really key piece of philosophical education. And I'm reminded, just in concluding, of a quotation that you'll have heard Willis using. And he said, philosophy of science is to scientists what ornithology is to birds. And, the birds aren't terribly interested, but actually the scientists should be interested in philosophy of science. And there's a new generation of philosophy of science coming up. Rupert Sheldrake's son Merlin is going to do a MPhil next year in philosophy of science. He's already got 2 first class degrees, and so you can see he's following in the old. Anyway, thank you so much, Elizabeth, for that wonderful presentation.